We are Kieran Maher.
Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the Ferret's Den, Kieran Maher Racing, a podcast dedicated to our data and sports science team. I'm your host, Mikey Barrett, once again joined by our head of sports science, Katrina Anderson.
Yes, very good to be back, and we are discussing a very interesting topic today.
We certainly are, and our head of data and performance, Josh Cadillac-Cavanagh.
Yep, an exciting topic here today about the battle of the sexes.
That could get us in a bit of trouble, but that's all right. We're looking at female athletes, both horses, and our very special guest in Genevieve Gregson, who is about to compete in her fourth Olympics, and this time in the marathon. But we'll get on to that shortly, because we started this, I guess, this idea for the podcast with, we wanted to talk about Pride of Jenny, right? She was the headline horse over the autumn. She made news around the world. But she truly transcended racing in the sense that, just that amazing visual of her running down the straight by herself at Royal Randwick. It did transcend racing. And we've been getting a lot of questions about it. And I came to you guys and I said, right, we need to do something regarding Pride of Jenny. TK, where did you start?
Well, as a ferret, I started digging. Now I understand the name of the podcast.
Yeah, there we go.
Obviously from a human perspective, we know that athletes improve endurance as they age in their career. And so I thought maybe it is the same with horses. You know, everyone kept asking, Pride of Jenny, you know, she started at, you know, her 12 and 1400, and now she's running 2000 and the way she's running it. So I started looking at if we did see that in horses. You know, found actually a good research paper, which we'll discuss, looking at the difference between male and female horses and also as they age. And then from there also just looking at our horses in our stable and looking at lactates and then correlating that between sex, age, gene type. And it was just actually quite interesting to see what I found, but then also trying to then work out how do we better train our horses based on that information.
All right. And Josh, this is probably, I mean, this is where it's great benefit to have a nice big sample size when we're looking at these things, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I've done some ferreting myself as well from a racing perspective, which we'll can go down into a little bit more. But it is an interesting one. Obviously, humans and horses are completely different. But looking at, obviously, the equine industry, and especially here in Australia, we're bred for speed. Early types, you know, we're bred for that sprinting caper. So more leaning towards the fast twitch fibres, in which we see a majority of our stable comes back a CC gene type, sort of 60 to 70%. But also the play with, gelding a young colt often is the case. So that takes away from the reproductive system, which obviously internally is affecting them differently. And obviously the mare is still... has an ability to reproduce later in life. You do see that later on, and I think I would say that it is harder to find sometimes excuses for mares later when they can run poor. Just one of mine that comes recently was horse Cardigan Queen, who just had two really flat runs, and then training wise looked all pretty normal, and then just came out and run a much better race recently at Flemington. So you do get that fluctuation in performance with the mares that. You know, is a little bit different to the geldings, and I would assume it's something to do there with possibly the reproductive system and, you know, being in season.
This is why we come to the ferrets, all right? They're looking at all the angles, and that's what I want to touch on. I want to touch on, I guess, firstly, the three metrics that you touched on before, which was sex, speed gene type, and what's the third one?
Age,
yes, exactly right. If you want to find out more about our speed gene tests, we'll put a link to a video that we've done on that explains that in the description for the episode. But TK, you went a bit deeper than that.
Yeah, so I found a paper. There's obviously always limited research in the horses, but there was a study looking at muscle fiber types. So you've got your type 1, which is your slow twitch, sort of oxidative, highly aerobic muscle, harder to fatigue, you know, good for endurance. Then you've got type 2A, so you've got two types of fast twitch muscle. You've got an A, which is your fast twitch, oxidative, glycolytic. So it's sort of between aerobic and anaerobic. So it's sort of...
So it's in the middle somewhere.
It's in the middle somewhere.
I'm just going to kind of try and keep it dumbed down for everyone because I'm hearing some terms that I'm not that aware of.
And then your type 2B, which is fast twitch glycolytic. So that's really explosive, anaerobic, produce lots of lactate and highly fatigue muscle. So looking at that, and then they took from 163 horses, half were mares, half were stallions, but age of 1, 2, 3, 4 plus. And across all, slow twitch muscles increased as they age. So that is
across boys and girls.
Boys and girls, yeah. There was no significant difference. There were more fast twitch 2A fibers in stallions compared to mares.
So they're the medium fast twitch ones.
Medium fast twitch. Yep. But they increased, they both increased as horses aged, which might be the way we train, or it's like, you know, adapting to training. But the interesting one was the fast twitch 2B fibers, the explosive ones. They were significantly higher in females compared to males. They both decreased across as horses age, which might be also train ability. Fast twitch B can turn to fast twitch A. Hopefully everyone's following. Well,
you will be tested on this later.
But, you know, at the age of 5, there was a significant difference between mares and stallions. So you'd say that mares are more suited to fast, explosive efforts. So
they're not losing their fast twitch muscles as quickly as the boys are, is what I'm
saying. And they also start, they have higher at the start.
At the start, okay.
And I always think back, you know, why, if you were horses in the wild, why would mares need to have that? Maybe it was to escape predators, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So I thought that was quite interesting. And then that sort of brings up the whole discussion around the mares being so dominant in the sprints this year, this season. And then you add another element to that. You've got a 2 kg difference between males and females.
Well, I do want to get onto that difference in a second. But Josh, you actually had a look at some of that race data that really does seem to back up what Katrina's saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's fascinating to see. And we'll try to post it on one of our EDMs that go out with this podcast, possibly in a nice visual way to ingest all that information. But looking at recent performance in the last few years at stakes level, sprinters, the ratio is quite dominant in the milers to the stayers in terms of the males to females winning those races. But when you look at the sprint distance, it's actually they win at 33% of the time, which looking at the milers...
That's the females.
Yeah, the females win. And they win... When you go up to a mile, it's beautifully linear in the way that it goes through, that it goes to 16% and then 12% for the stayers. And then I pulled it out for, obviously, we wanted to have a look at how Kieran trains, because I do believe that he does train similar in that way, that they do perform very well over a sprint trip, and we've got some great ones in at the moment. And he's sort of looking at, he's actually trained more winners in the last sort of 10 years, looking at that data, in a stakes race than the males have. So he's trained more mares or fillies.
That backs up the eye test, I think, as well. Yep. And that's what he kind of particularly early does is sort of known for. And a lot of those early pin-up horses of Kieran's, whether it was like Sir Candy or Jamaica, et cetera, did tend to be mares, but it's balanced out a bit. But, yeah, it is backed up by the numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. He's actually a little bit different to the population in that way that sort of he's about 3% with the stayers, so the population is about 11%. So that's not comparative like for like at all. You can't really compare the two. But looking at the ratio between the two of 8% sprinters that are fillies and mares versus stayers that are 3%, and then looking at the sprinters of the overall population, that it's about 33% to 11%. So it's an interesting one to look at. I just don't think the gap is interesting at the stayer level as well, because we were just going through some of the results before and looking at the elite. Probably two staying races in Australia, which are the Melbourne Cup and the Sydney Cup. In the Melbourne Cup, the last 10 years, there's only been two horses that have placed or so won.
That's two out of 30.
Mares.
Yeah.
Yep. Sorry, mares.
We know one of them. One of them was we know both motion. Of them, really, let's be honest.
She ran a very good very good race behind Gold Trip. And then the other one was probably debatably in the last 10 years was the best Melbourne Cup winner, I think, is Very Elegant's dominant win. And then same for the Sydney Cup, looking back there. Kieran obviously trained Etta James there, which was an incredible...
One for the believers.
Incredible win. And then the likes of a good New Zealand horse by mare by the name of Rondinella, who was very good, and Miami Bound, who I think both of those are broodmares now, and one of them is in Japan. So it's an interesting look into that. And there was only four, in the last 9 years in the Sydney Cup that had placed or won. So it is a hard... They're up against it there.
Coming back to Pride of Jenny, though, TK, because that's what the people want to hear about. There were some indications early on that she should be out to be able to get out to that sort of longer trip that we got her to.
Yeah, obviously we use lactates to give us a guide about, you know, where a horse's best trip is. We won't go into details about lactate, but she, if I look at the difference between... if we break down our population, sex and age, she was always in that elite area where she was lower lactate compared to the population of females, even at an early age. And it's sort of, if I then look at just the way we train our horses, you know, looking at, we've brought up that Kieran has been very good at training stayers, whether they are male or female. I think, especially with the use of data, over the recent few years that I've been here, we're getting really good at digging deeper into each individual horse and making sure that we are training them right. And if we look at muscle fibre types and gene types, you've got sprinters, middle distance and stayers based on your gene type. So you know that those CC horses, sprinters, will be much higher in that fast twitch muscle. And we know that fast twitch muscle... I've actually found another paper which we could add. Or
we'll add it. No, do you know what? We'll add it. We'll make sure we just put a little explainer on top so it's not complete gobbledygook.
This is in humans. Yep. When they fatigued muscle, the slow twitch muscle group, 20 minutes later, they were recovered. 5 hours later, the fast twitch muscles were still, the fast twitch group were still recovering. So that just really shows you the difference in muscle type. And if you are training your horses wrong based on those, you know, you're going to fatigue them, you're not going to get the most out of them. And so I think, you know, using interval training and taking lactates and making sure that we're not overreaching on those sprinters or I just think the whole topic is really interesting, and getting the most out of our horses based on that and individualizing it. And I think there's a lot more that we can do in the area, and I could keep talking about it and keep talking about it because
hey, we've really got more episodes to go. But I will say that individualized training, like we've seen a number of success cases with it. It's not how all trainers use these data measurements, but for me it's the most exciting thing to see us get the most out of these horses by getting an understanding of what they're handling, what they're not, what they're better suited to, what they're not, and then, well, the results speak for themselves.
Yeah, and it'll be really interesting to listen to the way Jen and her training group and how they've used those sort of measurements as well, and how it correlates back to horses. And I think that's really cool that we're sort of digging deeper and finding those correlations between humans, horses, and then where they are different as well.
Absolutely.
I think it'd be interesting as well to hear that. I think you'd know more than this, Kat, more on this, but I believe the gap between humans, male and female, obviously lessens over a distance. Is that correct? We're actually much closer over a marathon distance than we are over a sprint.
Yeah,
probably so standardised for the distance as well.
Yeah, and then if you go further again and you look at ultra running, you have females competing with men and beating men. Like, you'll always find a female on the top.
Which is interesting. It's sort of the opposite to what we just said with horses.
Exactly.
There's obviously, with those Melbourne Cup figures, but maybe are we training horses wrong? Or we could just be completely different anatomically in that way, in that sense.
Yeah, I had these discussions with Kieran when I was talking about this, and I was saying, so maybe we're, you know, training males right, and I was like, well, actually we could be training the females wrong. And then it was like, I think I confused Kieran more, but I think we'll continue to look at what the science is and how we're seeing that in horses and the way we're training them, and then maybe we can, you know, Kieran is all for trying new things, and that's what's so great about working here and what makes them so good. So I think it's an interesting area, and I think that we can do a lot more.
And I think, look, there's plenty of stuff that we've covered today, but we do want to get to the interview with Genevieve. Before we do, though, Josh, on the spot, 2 kilos weight for age between the boys and the girls. Is it time to do away with that? Is there anything that backs up a decision to go one way or the other? Because to the eye, it does seem like the gap is closed.
Yep. I think the data backs that up as well. I just put it out, and Kieran is actually very, very much above the population in that he, when he puts a filly or a mare against the boys, he actually goes much, much better than the population, and they actually go stronger. Now, it's a little bit tricky to work out why that is. It could be the fact that a lot of other trainers place horses in these fillies and mares races, conditions-wise, because they just don't think they're up to them, and that actually makes them even a better race, so they're harder to win. But Kieran's strike rate, when you take out the maidens and the in sort of stakes level races, so you're looking at the middle of the park, they are really significant numbers, sort of 50% better, the win rate, and similar sort of pattern with the place rate. So it is quite incredible when they do say in the form references, dropping back to fillies and mares grades, I'd be wary sometimes that those horses actually might stack up against the boys. And then, you know, it's amplified, like we've said before, at the sprint trips, and then going out to a distance, obviously, it'd be hard to find some fillies and mares races for them over a distance. There's just not that many races in Australia for stayers straight up. So it is hard to put them in that race, so it is tricky. But yeah, there is probably a discussion there around 2 kilos, and having 2 kilos over 1,000 metres versus, you know, 2,200 metres also is bemusing to me.
Look, it's just one of those things in racing that hasn't been changed for a long time, but we're here to challenge all of those things. And that strike rate, that just sounds like great placement to me.
Sounds like great placement, but
is that your job, Josh?
Kat and I would like to change that a little bit more. I think we've seen a couple lately go to fillies and mares grade. I think we've got a few coming up running that have dropped back as well to fillies and mares grade, which I think we probably should have looked elsewhere.
Oh, well, once Kieran listens to this podcast, because he will.
Yes, of course. We've got to get the boss on soon as well. He's a busy man at the moment, running around with horses running in 3 states, little Eliza, and keeping his eye on everything. But I'll tell you what, the data and sports science team help him do that. Josh, Katrina, we've got to get to this interview because it is a ripper. TK and I will stick around and interview Jen. And we'll catch you guys soon.
Thank you. Enjoy the podcast.
Up next on this edition of the Ferret's Den, we've got a very special guest, soon to be a 4-time Olympian. Genevieve Gregson joins us. Genevieve, thank you so much for joining us. We're really excited to have a chat. I know Katrina, being a runner herself, is. Just tell us a little bit about yourself for those that don't know.
Yeah, no. Hi, guys. I'm happy to be here. I am an Olympic distance runner, formerly a track runner. I've done a lot of my career on the track with the, I guess you would call it, shorter distances compared to what I do now. But inevitably I've always been destined to be in aerobic events. So I started off doing a bit of cross country as a kid, which kind of transitioned into the 3K steeplechase and also 5,000, 10,000 type of stuff on the track. And after Tokyo Olympics, I had a horrific injury. I ruptured my Achilles tendon and decided it was time to put away the spikes and the intensity of track and move up to the longer stuff and start marathon running. So I've actually only done 2 marathons, but the good thing is I nailed them, and the second one qualified me for my 4th Olympic Games. So I will be competing in Paris in the marathon.
That's fantastic. I love it. Most people would rupture an Achilles and think, you know what, maybe running's not for me anymore. You're like, no, let's just run further.
Yeah, we'll just change the event.
And Katrina, that's one of the big reasons we wanted to get it on Jen today. Obviously, we've been talking a bit about Pride of Jenny. And Jen, I saw when Katrina slid into your DMs to see if you'd wanted to come on the show. You've been following Pride of Jenny a bit.
Yeah, I actually print screen Katrina's message, and we have a group chat on WhatsApp called Bangalore Turf Club, and it's our punting chat. So we have like I have 3 brothers, 2 of them are in it. My father-in-law's in it. My husband's in it. His best mate's in it. And it's just a group of people that all like to send in tips and follow horses. So Pride of Jenny is actually one that pops up quite a lot because she's obviously had some very good recent form, but we also do a lot of omen betting. And Jenny, even though my name is Genevieve, family have always called me Jenny, and it came from my grandma. I used to hate it. She'd always call me Jenny, Jenny. So we started betting and following that horse a long time ago. And just of recent time, my brother is just constantly sending in tips being like, get on her, get on her. So I was really excited when I was reached out by Katrina and I sent it through and everyone's like, no way, like definitely do that podcast. That's so good.
Yeah, well, you would have made a bit of money on Pride of Jenny after this campaign.
Yeah, she's a good horse.
No, I was, you know, when we had the idea of looking at Pride of Jenny, obviously following her performances this season, there were so many questions asked about, you know, what makes her different? How can she get over this trip? How can she run the way she does? And so we were trying to find like the human athlete version, and I straight away thought of you, and I didn't even think about the Jen and Jenny.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that close, but yeah, we weirdly draw some sort of omen bet out of it.
That's fantastic. Obviously, I suppose we'll just dive a bit further into the reason why we got you on, but, you know, it's sort of a common observation that when you look at endurance runners and athletes, and they sort of tend to perform better over further as they age, and we've obviously seen that with Jenny. How have you found that transition from 3K to marathon, especially training perspective-wise? Like, how has your training changed, whether that's volume, intensity? I don't know if you just talk a bit through that.
Yeah, so obviously always being a distance type of athlete, I knew that I would always have the option of moving up distances as I got older. I think for, you know, track athletes that do the 100 or the 200, you know, they may go to the 400, but even that seems a bit of a stretch. But as a distance athlete, if you can do, you know, that 3K distance, that 5K distance, you usually have the engine to keep moving up. So it was definitely always the plan for me to do that. And it normally coincides with athletes feeling like they're getting a bit slower on the track and losing that speed and kind of responsiveness to the faster pace stuff. But for me, the main transition came from injury. I did need to step away from the intensity of track training. Not that it was too much different, but there was more emphasis on the shorter reps, hill reps to get a bit of power, gym and plyometrics and all that type of stuff to just kind of hold on to any power that I might have had. Whereas shifting to the longer stuff, we've reduced the intensity completely, and it's all that kind of heart rate threshold stuff where we spend a lot of time in that zone before you develop lactic. And for me, that's where I function my best. I can run at a really high heart rate for quite a long time, and I've known that a long time. We used to do our physiology tests on a treadmill, and they spike your finger to find out your blood lactate, and I actually cannot spike my blood lactate past a certain level, but I can sit on low levels forever. You know, you can keep trying to like put the speed up on the treadmill and it'll just keep kind of tinkering around a very low millimole. And that just showed that the marathon was the event that I was probably going to find a lot of success in. And so my week looks pretty similar when it comes to just most days a week, but where the significant change is with a Friday session that used to be a shorter threshold, so around 30 minutes. I now will do a big marathon session that could be, you know, up to 90 minutes of running even, but, you know, lower intensity, lower pace. And then on Sunday, that going from a 90-minute run, like a 21 to 25K run, that now can get up to 35K of just continuous running. Again, not a fast, strong pace, just a nice, steady, rolling rhythm pace that, you know, I kind of find myself falling into quite often. And so I've actually responded really well to this type of training. I don't get tired as much. I don't feel like my body gets cooked, you know, like I'm pulling up better. And I think a lot of the past, it's come from it's better for women with the transition. I think with men, they just lose testosterone as they get older. So they lose speed and their endurance also suffers. Whereas with women, we kind of lose estrogen, but that doesn't affect our aerobic ability. We still can, you know, keep improving aerobically. We might not get faster at the shorter paces, but we can, you know, extend our aerobic capacity and keep running longer. And then even after that, they say that babies no longer are slowing us down. That kind of gives you a whole nother spike with the growth hormones and stuff. So we really get a whole new lease on life at the second half of our career, whereas men slowly just will fade when they kind of get over 30. It gets a lot harder.
Well, it's about time something went the other way. There are two things you touched on there that I'd love to, for you to guys to discuss a little bit more. The first thing is lactates and what that means, because obviously we do a lot of lactate testing with our horses. And then secondly, just that revised training program where you were able to find that sweet spot for yourself. Mm-hmm. I know it's something that Katrina has put a lot of work in with our horses and finding that sweet spot where they're not cooking themselves. Yeah, I'd love to hear you both sort of talk a little bit about that. And I guess for lactates, for the layman out there, what that signifies, a lower or higher lactate level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for example, my husband, he is a 1500 meter runner. You know, he went to two Olympics for the 1500, was the first man in 40 years to make a final, like very good at spiking his lactate. And when I talk about these physiology tests we would get, they put you on a treadmill and you up the levels, up the pace, and you eventually just tap out when it's too much. But every level or so, when we get the blood lactate, they're looking for, you know, that millimole level to increase. And with him, it'll sit at like 2, then maybe climb to 3. But when it gets to around hitting 4, it'll just like jump to 8, then maybe even 12. Whereas with me, every level that I progress through, it was like 2, 2. Maybe got to 3, then it would be 3, 3. And then we're getting to like a pace where my legs actually can't physically go any faster. So I'm tired, but when they do my last check, I'm like 4 millimole, maybe 4.5. And like, I have to stop because my legs can't physically spin any faster. My heart rate's through the roof. And I've been running for 40 minutes, but yeah, it's kind of like the end of the test. So it just shows that with just my genetic makeup, that's, I'm going to suit long aerobic, like sub threshold or sub lactic threshold point. And that's what this marathon work has been. So a Friday session typically can be anywhere from, you know, a continuous run around 30 minutes. But at the moment training for Paris, we extend the sessions more like 20K. So the last week I had 20 by 1K. Where it was 1K at 3:15 per K pace and then 1K at 3:45, and I just fluctuate back and forth. So the 3:45 pace for me is sub threshold. Like that's almost recovery run pace because, you know, I'm fit and I find that pace pretty comfortable. But then when you bring me down to a 3:15, if I held that 3:15 for too long, I would start to spike my blood lactate a little bit. But it's, you know, only for 3:15, so you know, before it gets too spicy, I can back off and recover again. And so you sit in like those zones just back and forth, but the session is 70 minutes, 75 minutes. And it's training that system to be more efficient as well. So threshold work allows you to become efficient at a pace where your body can create lactic and shuttle it at the exact same time so that it never builds and tips you over the point of where you, you know, seize up or vomit or whatever, you know, what happens to people that spike their lactate. So it's really interesting that I've responded to that so well. It almost makes me think that as a track runner, I probably should have had more of that work to just give me a better base and then work on speed on top of that. So this week I have 7 by 2K, the same thing, like the 2K will be around 3:20 pace. Again, that's close to my marathon pace. And then I have 2 minutes off still jogging where I back off closer to 4 minute pace to recover, go again, do that 7 times. And again, it's approaching an hour of work, but I never kind of get to a point where it burns or it hurts or I feel nauseous. It's just, you know, that low intensity sting that you feel like you could hold for quite some time. And yeah, it's just been really, really beneficial in making me more fitter than I could have ever imagined.
Oh my God, it's incredible hearing that. People will be mind blown by the paces you're running. But it is interesting from that perspective. We look at lactates with horses, but we can't take sort of a continued lactate. We just get one measure. So from there, we sort of have to work out, you know, how hard the horse is working or at what point that threshold is. And you do find that some horses will just spike, but their heart rate will be fine. And the other, you get the version where, like part of Jenny, her lactate is always low. It doesn't really matter what we do with her. Her lactate is, you know, she'll do pretty
sharp. She's like me.
On the trend, it'll be 2.4. Yeah, she's like
That's
why. A couple of Jennies.
Yeah.
So we have to use that to manage that we don't, you know, overtrain a horse or they're not doing too much, you know, every week. Otherwise, they're obviously going to get fatigued, and you probably find that yourself, obviously, if you're managing that intensity that you can maintain, and then you can get fitter without overburdening yourself, and you can
and that's the new research that actually is becoming big in the endurance world, and it's actually coming out of Norway with a superstar runner that's on the track at the moment. And it's the blood lactate work. It's, you know, making sure that they never tip over the point where they do produce too much, because they're finding that if you can train in that zone below producing lactate for a long period of time, but just do more of it, like they're doing double sessions, they'll do like a big session in the morning, then another big session at night, but always spiking their fingers and making sure that their blood lactate never tips over, they're becoming like the fittest people on the circuit. Like, they're just really impressive, this new method of training. And although I'm doing probably a less scientific version, because I don't test my blood lactate at training, for me, because I've been running for so long, it's a feeling. I do wear a heart rate monitor. I know where that point is. I know the feeling of when I'm probably going too hard and I'm now turning it in from aerobic session to an anaerobic session. And I think that's really important, because the crazy thing is, if you train a little easier in that zone but hit it, you know, right, and you hold it there for a long period of time, like the sessions I do, versus going too hard, you actually get fitter. You have more gains aerobically and recovery is better. And I think that's been really hard back in the day for people to wrap their head around with running. It's just like, run as hard as you can, you know, run till you vomit, you know, run faster is better. And they're proving now that there is a science behind like pulling it back a little bit, staying under that lactate threshold, and you actually get fitter from it.
Well, some pretty obvious correlations there to horse training as well, TK, just given obviously it was done the same way for, you know, 150 years. And it's only really been in the last few years that we're really starting to see a lot of commonly held views challenged. And Katrina and her team have certainly been leading that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you would follow Kieran and Kieran and I racing and how we've sort of been, would say we'd be the first stable to sort of introduce sports science to training horses. And in the time that I've been here, 4 years, and just seeing the change in the way Kieran trains based on getting those metrics back. And I think that the main difference I've seen in our training is that we definitely don't train our horses as hard, or the intensity has dropped, but like you say, we're getting our horses fitter because they're doing more of that sort of within their threshold. And it's interesting to hear
from that is so interesting, because it's the same in running. Like, I would say only in the last few years, like maybe 5-6 years, is where this new style has been universally taken on. So in the past, there have been obviously a lot of runners, especially distance running, the same as cycling, where drugs are involved. So it's hard to like believe what you hear, and people just assume that it's EPO or something that's making someone extra fit. So to actually have science proving that there are ways to train to really benefit aerobically, and this latest theory of making sure that you're actually not training too hard, has been a really big hit, and the running world, like world records are coming down all the time. Like people are getting fitter and faster, and like times are dropping. And I think it's just a lot of it is due to the fact that there's knowledge now coming in. There's science proving that there are specific ways to train, and you can do it a certain way to perfect it. I think, yeah, just back in the day, it was run any way you see fit and run it as hard as you can. But yeah, there's definitely a science to it. And I'm so surprised that they can use that with horses, but it makes total sense to me.
Well, I mean, one that we've sort of touched on a number of times, Katrina, would be someone like Royal Merchant's program, who she was a pretty limited, that's a bit unfair, but she basically ended up winning a Group One at the end of the prep. And from the early days, I remember Katrina and Joe, assistant trainer at Warwick Farm, she wasn't, am I right in saying, she wasn't handling the work we were giving her initially on the treadmill, and they put together a specific program. Katrina, you can talk a little bit more about it, where we really just saw a horse who was going from sort of low grade benchmark races to winning a Group One. It was quite incredible.
Yeah, I think that was the first example where I was able to show Kieran that, you know, you don't have to follow the one plan, or don't have to train the horses hard to get them if they're not, you know, seemingly fit enough to do that work. Instead of, you know, train them harder, they obviously need to get trained harder. We actually step it back, and just we were breaking up treadmill work. So instead of doing, there were sort of steps in between the original plan, just so that horse was able to handle that work and then get fitter from it, so then they could handle the next step. And yeah, she just always handled her work, and then the difference I saw on her work on the track was, yeah, it was quite eye-opening, especially for Kieran to see that it's not the one set plan. And also just, yeah, the importance of, I suppose, like yourself, would be listening to your body and making sure that you're handling your work. And then
I think it's interesting as well.
I was just gonna say, with the being able to handle training and absorb the work, I can compare that to, you know, sometimes we in our training group, a guy will be kind of thrown to the girls group and he's like, hey, you're the girls pacer for today. And usually guys don't handle that well, because, you know, it's a hit to the ego that they're getting dropped into the girls group. But we find that a guy that gets put in the girls group and you know, he's pulled back a little bit, the paces are slower, and they can do the whole session leading and get a lot out of it, they actually end up having a really good season. They get fitter faster because they've been dropped from the guys group because they're one of the weaker guys, and they're probably absolutely killing themselves to hang on for all the reps and sets, and the times are probably a bit fast. But when they move back to the girls group to a more doable times that they absorb better, they're getting the whole session in, their heart rate isn't spiking, they're probably not developing any lactic too early, they respond better from it and actually end up getting fitter as the season goes on. And there will be a point where it's too slow, and then they can move back up to the boys group. But it just shows a very more simple way that sometimes there is a different way to train, and it can actually bring you on way more than trying to do it the old school way.
Are there things, I think we've obviously seen a huge rise in like things like social run clubs in the morning, and running is certainly enjoying quite a boom. Are there things in these sort of training techniques that you sort of everyday person trying to maybe get a little bit faster, or trying to build up to their first marathon or things like that? Are there things in these training techniques that they can take away?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're forever trying to, my husband and I have an online coaching business where we're getting everyday runners that want to run their first marathon or want to break.
Oh, give it a plug.
Give it a plug. Hour limit. And so we explain this to them, you know, because it's actually the recreational runners are the harder ones to train, because they're the type of people that head out for a park run every Saturday and just do an all-out effort. And it's like, we don't, as professional athletes, we don't head out every Saturday and give an all-out effort. Like, that would be crazy. And so we try to explain to them a little bit of the science of training, so that they know it's okay for training to feel doable and easy. You don't have to kill yourself every day to feel like you're improving. And, you know, sometimes being an online business, it is hard to see their day-to-day efforts, but we get them to log all their heart rate work because we can tell by their smartwatch whether they're trying too hard or not. And I think that's also been really handy because we understand the scientific side of it. We can say, hey, look, I know you said you went out for an easy 50-minute run, but your heart rate was like hitting 190. So let's chill, you know, next time Lies. You get out the door. Yeah, like slow that pace down and maybe even have a break in the middle if you feel like it's a bit much. So, yeah, we do try use the techniques to help the everyday jogger.
That's great. We might need to get Josh to sign up to that. Josh is our head of data and performance here who will be heard in other parts of this program. What's the business called? We'll drop a link to it in the
description. It's called Gregson Running. So it's just, there's our website, gregsonrunning.com.au. But yeah, it's on our social medias too.
Excellent. All right. We'll certainly give that a plug as well. Because, yeah, like I say, I've got so many friends who just, yeah, it really has become more and more of a social thing as well as a fitness thing.
Yeah, it's a running boom. We're in a running boom for sure.
Yes.
Just thinking about the using the heart rate in training as we do with horses, do you also use your smartwatch sort of recovery wise? Do you look at those sort of metrics or how you sleep, and does that help you decide on, or do you make changes to training based on those sort of metrics?
Yeah, I don't actually use a smartwatch for tracking sleep. But it doesn't mean that I don't consider it. I can't wear a watch or anything when I sleep. I prefer not to. But being a newish mother, that has definitely been something that's really significantly changed in my life. You know, I went from being an athlete and my husband being an athlete, and it was 8 hours of sleep, absolutely no questions asked, maybe even an hour nap during the day on training camps. Whereas we're not that blessed with the flexibility of good hours sleep now. So I do try to just factor in the fact that if there was a rough night, I really follow my heart rate. And if I'm tired, I actually find, and I don't know if this is the same with horses, if I'm having a bad day where I think my body's kind of screaming out for a rest or that I'm fatigued, not deep set, but, you know, surface fatigued, my heart rate won't get up. I can go out for a threshold and look at my numbers, and in the first 5 minutes, I'm usually in the zone that I should be in. If I'm really tired, it just will never get there. And I can, you know, even try like surge and spike it, and it'll just stay really low, or I can't even get it close within like 5-6 beats. And that's a pretty big indicator to me that I need to, you know, take a day or so, whether it's more sleep, you know, eat better, feel better. I have markers in with my heart rate that kind of are red flags when things need to be addressed. So that's nice to always feel like I can check in pretty quickly whether I'm responding well or not. And it's very rare that this happens, but it has happened. And there's usually not really an answer for it. Sometimes I might even be trying to get more sleep and I feel like I am clocking the right hours, but not really kind of responding well. And yeah, I just really try to follow my heart rate to make sure that nothing seems worrying when I'm in a big block of training.
That's really interesting. Obviously we can't get that feedback from the horses, as in they can't talk to us.
Yeah, but yeah,
it would be difficult. Like, we would often go the other way, so if their heart rate was a lot higher than usual, like when they're trotting or they're in the work, we would say that would be a sign that they're not handling the work as well. But I don't think we've ever really considered that if the heart rate is a lot lower than it usually is, that they're potentially fatigued. So when your heart rate is lower, you're still hitting the right pace, but you're just
that's not okay. Heart rate up. That means you're really fit. So if my heart rate's really low but I'm still hitting the paces that seem normal, that's a great sign. That could be that it's cooler outside, or you're extra fresh today, and or you've adapted well. But where I notice it's, you know, fatigue and kind of a red flag for me is heart rate's low. I'm obviously struggling with pace, and even if I surge my pace, my heart rate still can't like link to it. Can't follow it. And fatigue, you were saying with the horses, if it's really high, that worries you. For us, if my heart rate was really high, but I was running the paces that I thought were, you know, meant to be, that wouldn't worry me either. If anything, I'd think maybe I had extra caffeine this morning. Maybe I'm more alert. Maybe it's a bit warmer. Again, being based in Brisbane, I have to also take note that if it's a hot day, my heart rate will naturally sit quite a bit higher. So they're not as worrying to me as a low heart rate that I can't get up even if I try.
I'm also just really interested. So I've had Achilles problems for the last 5 years. And it's sort of derailed my running career. I've rehabbed it. I've got back to racing again and it's fleet up again. And I know that you obviously rupturing your Achilles, but I was listening to a podcast and you actually had ongoing Achilles problems mm-hmm. with your other Achilles. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, like the bizarre. Managing
that.
Yeah. Sorry, you keep going.
Just like managing that through your career and then also the rehab and like how you've rehabbed both Achilles, returning mm-hmm. to running, and I suppose how you've made changes ongoing. Has it changed the way you train or do you rehab things like prehab?
Yeah, I think, a lot of people don't realize, I have said it in a few interviews, but the Achilles I ruptured was an Achilles that I had not had previous, well, not really had previous issues with ever. I did have issues probably just the last month leading into the Olympics, which I think maybe is the reason. But the main reason I think I ruptured my right Achilles was because for 5 years on my left Achilles, I had, you know, Haglund's deformity, which is where the bone grows and kind of rubs on the tendon and the bursas are always inflamed. I had tendinopathy, which just is annoying in itself. So my left lower leg in general was very weak. Wasn't very powerful. The calf probably withered a little bit over those years just because you're always favoring it. With the steeplechase, I would always push off on my left because the right had to like take your whole body landing in the pit. So the last month or so leading into the Olympics in Tokyo, I had actually really flared up my bad Achilles to a point where it was just agonizing. Like it was really hard to even put it on the ground, but you know, I'm a month out from the Olympics where I thought I was going to go really well. I was in career best form. So I kept training, but just favoring the left so much that that right leg was just, you know, building up more and more tension, just carrying my whole body. I remember my coach even commenting saying like, you look awful. You look like you're running on one leg. And I think the Achilles tendon on the right side, like it's not invincible. It just got to a point where it was like, I can't hold your body forever. And it was on the last water pit of my race where it just like clean snapped. And the doctor that worked on me, the surgeon, he actually said it snapped with that much force that it was so clean. There was no fraying. The tendon was so healthy, but the snap was so clean that it was actually quite an easy surgery. The two ends of the tendon came together really nicely and they tied it up nicely. And I think it's healed very well because since that surgery, other than, you know, the rehab, which is grueling in itself, it's just, you know, your foot, you have to learn how to walk again and the proprioception has to be kind of rebuilt and everything. Like I did so much rehab on it. You know, I say I have no issues and I haven't had an issue with it since. And, you know, I'm nearly 3 years down the track. I did a lot of work, hours and hours a day, 5 days a week to get it to that point. But with my left, the most amazing thing was it was so bad for so long. And when I had this surgery while I was pregnant, again, like I rehabbed it and came back from it and it's just never even been stiff in the like in the middle of the night when you go to the bathroom and you can't walk because your tendons are all seized. Like I don't even have that. And I think why that is I pretty much reset the tendon and then built the muscles back in my calf before trying to run again. And I think the issue with people that have Achilles problems is they're forever managing it and forever trying to learn how to still train and race with it, and little things like your calf just slowly, you know, practice bad habits and wither away and you favor it in different ways. Whereas when I got this complete reset and it was time away from running, I could strengthen my body in every possible way, whether it was my feet, my soleus, my calf, my knees, everything, before I attempted to run again. And I think now I just have like a stronger foundation for the tendon to work with, so that there's not, you know, all these inconsistencies and weaknesses. So I'm praying that I never have that Achilles issue again, but my body was crying out for a reset. And I essentially think that's where I got to, is just starting again, because I'd run through it for way too long.
Yeah, that's what us runners do. We just
exactly
continue to manage. And the weird thing is we get used to it. And so when, because I've had cortisone a couple of times on it, and then when you do all your rehab and you do find that that and you have no pain, you get up in the middle of the night and there's no pain, it's like a weird feeling. And you're like, man, running is so good when you're pain-free.
That's what I've found. Like, I love running way more than ever before, because I go for a run and nothing – like, I used to kind of like swear into the wind because it was so painful. It was just like, oh, I can't bear this. But I was just running through something so painful all the time that you just get, that's your normal and you get used to it. And it's so much more draining than to just walk out the door and feel like your tendons aren't about to snap under you.
Yeah, so that we obviously have to manage our horses with injuries. You know, part of being a professional athlete is, you know, that you're pushing yourself to the limit, and and you know that horses will be feeling sorenesses here and there, but it's knowing when to back off or how to manage when they are compensating, because we do find that horses will compensate, and it's usually the other leg that we start having issues with if they're compensating on a soreness. But I suppose away from sort of this, looking forward to your Paris Olympics, what are your aspirations? I know you obviously dropped from 2 hours 28 to 2 hours 23, which I think you sort of surprised yourself. So what have you going into the Olympics, what are your goals? Or
it's a hard, really hard one, because when you're a track runner, every track is the same. The only thing that could possibly change is conditions, but you go into a championship knowing what those conditions will be. With the marathon, it's a whole different game, really. The course, which I've heard enough about now that it gives me nightmares, is going to be brutal. It's essentially 15K of flat, and then you begin a climb from 15K to 20K. And then there's a few downs and then some spiked hills that are like 13.5% gradient. It's just, there's 17K smack bang in the middle of the race of just directly up or directly down. And then the last 10K of the race is flat again. So it's really hard to train for. And like I've been kind of explaining to you guys how what I really, really do well in is this work on a Friday where it's, you know, 70 to 90 minutes of continuous running at a steady pace that I can handle. We're now trying to incorporate hills, and that's really difficult as a marathon runner to gauge pace up a hill, even down a hill, and to know what effort you give, but you've still got to keep in mind that there's a long way to go. So it's been a really strange block so far because, we're doing a lot of hill work. And going into Paris, I think a course like this will actually suit me. So when you take away a flat, predictable course, it just adds kind of more chance for not underdogs, but girls that don't have the fastest PBs, because at the end of the day, I'm ranked probably 15th or 20th when it comes to PBs in this race. But everyone's got to have a good day to pull it off. And there's going to be a lot of girls with fast PBs that just run a little bit too hard up those hills and, come tumbling down. And my goal is to go in being extremely in tune with my heart rate, with how my body's feeling, and try to just make the right decisions the whole way, so that when it comes to that last 10K, I can give a type of effort that'll allow me to do a lot of damage to athletes that maybe judged it wrong. And I know everyone probably has a similar tactic, but one thing I have always been good at when it comes to road racing is judging pace and effort. And I think I did that really well in my last two marathons because I was getting to the last 5K and actually negative splitting and getting faster. Whereas, you know, typically in a marathon, you blow up somewhere in that last 10K and just get to the finish. So, you know, I would, if I finished in the top 10, I think that would be really, really great. But deep down, I'd like to finish in the top 8 and have my best Olympic finish yet and really kind of try to be closer to that top pack at the pointy end of the race.
Exciting. We'll certainly all be cheering you on, everyone at Kieran Maher Racing and certainly everyone in Australia. Our next Pride of Jenny.
Yeah, and thanks.
Maybe
yeah.
we can get you down to come down yeah. and see Pride of Jenny in the Cox Plate. That will be her. Oh,
I would
Olympics.
Love that. That'll be so fun. It's a good time of year for us too, you know. We cool. essentially call that, I guess, off season. It's road racing season, but we call it off season.
Oh, perfect. We can certainly make that happen. Jen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. I know you're very busy in the lead up to the Olympics. As I said, we'll certainly all be watching on with bated breath and we'll certainly have to get you down to Cranbourne as well to meet Jenny leading into the Cox Plate.
No, I would love that.
Thank you
Thanks
so much.
Much.
All the best.
Yeah, thank you guys.
All the best
I
Olympics and yeah, carry on.
I really enjoyed this different type of interview, so thanks for including me in it, and yeah, would love to get down at some point to see my Pride of Jenny.
Say hello to the Bangalore Turf Club
yeah,
as well.
I will. I
yeah,
love
well,
that.
Should I follow the Kieran Maher Racing Formcast?
Yeah, well, they'll.
Yeah, you might need to get some of the Formcast tips in there. Katrina's been on fire of late. She tipped her $8 winner on Saturday.
I'll add you to my chat. I'll be a hero. Because we're not allowed to claim a win unless we sent the tip in. So you can't just chime into the chat and be like, right. "Oh, I won this." And it's like, no. If we didn't see your tips, like, keep your brag to yourself.
So. Fair enough. Right.
Tips, not slips. That's the rule. Jen, thank you so much for that. Good luck with the Olympics. We'll be following on, and we'll look forward to catching up with you afterwards.
No worries. Thanks so much, guys.
We are Kieran Maher.